By the time he left Texas to seek his fortune in California in 1849, Jack Hayes had proved a point. He had shown, many would have said incontrovertibly, that Comanches could be hunted, pursued to their villages, fought on their own terms, and beaten. He had invented a new form of warfare, and he had invented its implausible agent of destruction, a lightly armed and lightly mounted man on a fast horse who wore an old slouch hat and scraggy beard and spit tobacco and defied absurd numerical odds against him. Hayes had adapted a weapon no one had wanted and turned it into the ultimate frontier sidearm, one that soon changed the very nature of the experience of the American West. By the time the Mexican War ended, a casual observer might have concluded that the tide had already turned against the Indians and that the Comanches, encased as they now were inside the pulsing American empire and facing a determined people who understood how to fight them, were going to meet their doom rather faster than one might have expected. Nothing of the sort happened. It was as though the Rangers had never happened, as though no one remembered what they had spilled the blood of so many young men to learn. No Rangers were consulted by anyone in Washington. Hayes, who had gone west with the gold rush and soon became sheriff of San Francisco County, was largely forgotten, at least for a time, as were his hard-riding comrades. The Rangers were disbanded, replaced by U.S. Army units. They were periodically reformed, which usually meant that a single captain recruited a band of men for an expedition with limited state funding, in 1850, 1852, 1855, 1857, and 1858. But most of these companies did little Indian fighting. Some fought small skirmishes with Lipan Apache raiders in far south Texas. A few fought Comanches. One of them went renegade, joining an ill-fated expedition under the command of an infamous adventurer to overthrow the government of Mexico. They ended by burning the Mexican border town of Piedras Negras and covering themselves with shame. The 1857 recruits, wrote Walter Prescott Webb, left practically no record of their presence on the frontier. One of their companies managed to find a small group of Indians, but was completely deceived and worsted by them. The notable exception to this was Rip Ford's 1858 expedition north of the Red River, of which more will be said later. But the inefficiency of the post-Hays Rangers paled next to the U.S. Army, which over a decade managed to engineer a retrogression of astounding scale and proportion. The cruel, lingering death of Martha Sherman in the fall of 1860 had another meaning as well. It was the harvest of a decade of federal incompetence, stupidity, and willful political blindness. The failure took many forms. In 1848 and 1849, the Army sent its engineers forth to build a line of five forts, stretching from Fort Worth, which was one of them, to San Antonio. They were obsolete the minute they were finished. The line of settlement had already engulfed them. There was also the problem of the men who were sent to occupy them. When it had withdrawn its forces from Mexico, the United States had sent seven companies of regulars to replace the Texas state troops. These consisted of infantry in various forms. Considering the advances in Indian warfare on the Texas frontier in the previous 10 years, this was a remarkable decision. It could only have been made by people in cravats and waistcoats who lunched at fancy hotels and lived 2,000 miles from the border. People, moreover, who did not want Indian wars and therefore did not want professional killers like Bigfoot Wallace out hunting redskins in their home ranges. In almost every way, the new Indian fighters were the antithesis of Hayes's men. The best examples were the Army's new elite fighters in the West, the Dragoons. They were a heavily mounted infantry who rode horses to the scene of battle, but fought dismounted. They were undoubtedly effective against comparably mounted and armed opponents, but on the Texas frontier, they were a shocking anachronism, like something out of Louis XIV's court. They were clad in French-inspired blue jackets, orange forage caps, white pantaloons, and sweeping mustaches. Like Louis's old musketeers, too, they were self-consciously gallant, in ways that would soon seem nearly comical. They were armed with weapons that the Spanish and Mexicans had long ago discovered to be useless against horse tribes. Single-shot pistols, apparently the army, unlike its Mexican war victims, had not quite grasped the meaning or value of the Walker Colt. Gleaming swords, which had no particular application against Indians, with 14-foot lances and rapid-fire arrows, and, oddest of all, the Springfield Arsenal musketoon, model 1842, a truly atrocious weapon that was unreliable at any distance. Heavy in the saddle, and not a real cavalry anyway, the splendidly arrayed horse infantry could barely manage 25 miles a day in pursuit of Indians. They often had to walk by their horses so as not to exhaust them. The warriors they pursued, pursuit being something the army in the West did not do very much of, could ride 50 miles in 7 hours and 100 miles without stopping, abilities the plodding, weighted-down dragoons simply refused to believe. The only way the Indians could ever be in danger from these soldiers, observed one Texas Ranger, was if their ridiculous appearance and ungainly horsemanship caused the Indians to laugh themselves to death. It was rather an unfortunate experiment to mount infantry soldiers, wrote a Ranger captain, many of whom had never been on horse in their lives, to operate against the best horsemen in the United States, the Comanche. Yet the United States Army tried it. One can only speculate on how long it would have taken Rangers under Hayes or Walker or McCulloch to leave them in pieces on the ground. It is not surprising that they never caught any Indians. Yet they were still far more efficient than the infantry, which made up the largest part of the troops then stationed on the frontier. The choice was a curious one, since the best an infantryman could do in such a vast and wide-open country against a fleet mounted opponent was to shoot his weapon from the gun portals of a stockade fence. Such a defensive notion was reasonable enough in places more civilized than the western frontier, but it had nothing to do with fighting horse Indians, who were never stupid or desperate enough to attack federal forts. They quickly learned to bypass them. Even before the posts were complete, citizens in some towns were calling for protection by rangers. In 1849, one Texas newspaper stated that the idea of repelling mounted Indians, the most expert horsemen in the world, with a force of foot soldiers, is ridiculous. It did not help that most of these men were foreign-born German and Irish, that many of them were criminals, led miserably demoralizing lives, and suffered greatly from disease, poor sanitation, and alcoholism. Yet this was the policy that seeped forth from Washington. That policy was deeply ambivalent. In 1849, the Home Department, later to become the Department of the Interior, had taken over the Office of Indian Affairs from the Army. In principle, this was a reasonable idea. But it set up two conflicting authorities. The Office of Indian Affairs was deeply committed to avoiding Indian wars in the West. It distrusted the Army and tended to disbelieve cries of wolf from the settlements, believing that the whites' problems with the Indians were of their own doing. They liked the idea of treaties, the more the better. They liked the notion of an enduring peace, in spite of the headlong rush of settlers into Indian territory who wanted peace only if it meant complete capitulation by Indians. The Army knew better, but could do nothing about it. The Indian Office was, moreover, deeply corrupt, full of agents who saw nothing wrong with cheating Indians of gifts or annuities or food allotments, acts that often led to bloodshed. The result was a policy of breathtaking passivity that lasted from 1849 to 1858. Soldiers were not to fight Indians unless attacked, or unless they had clear evidence that the Indians had been involved in a criminal act. The government's approach was purely defensive. Thus, the new line of forts, built 100 miles to the west and finished by 1852, were not much more effective than the first ones. Not at first, anyway. Though they had been built at great expense, they were typically understaffed and underfunded. Infantrymen could do little more than drill and march about the parade ground. Pursuit of mounted Comanches by foot troops was pointless. The forts were built to stop Indian raids on both the Texas frontier and northern Mexico, yet through most of the 1850s, they were ineffective. As Wallace and Hobel wrote, "Officers and troops were strangely ignorant of the rudiments of warfare as carried on by the Indians of the plains." The failure at the federal level also extended to treaties, which were no different from any of the failed treaties signed by the government of the United States from its earliest days. One historian has estimated the number of treaties made and broken by the government at 378. The outcome of nearly every treaty was the same. White civilization advanced, Aboriginal civilization was destroyed, subsumed, pushed out. The government made claims it could never enforce and never intended to enforce, and Indians died. This is a dreary history. The five civilized tribes were chased westward by a series of treaties, each of which guaranteed that this time the government promises would be kept, that this time the Trail of Tears would end. Some of this treaty-making was pure hypocrisy. Some of it, as in the case of Texas Indian agent Robert Neighbors, was earnest and well-meaning naivete. Indians always wanted agreements that would last for all eternity. No white man who ever signed one could have possibly believed that the government could ever make such promises. An enormous amount of energy was expended making pointless treaties with Comanches. A brief summary will suffice to make the point. The first treaty was made in 1847 with the Penaticas, who of course could not enforce any of its provisions on the other bands. Its terms were typical. Indians were to give up captives and restore stolen goods, accept the jurisdiction of the United States, and trade only with licensed traders. In exchange, the government promised that no whites would be permitted to go among the Indians without a pass signed personally by the President of the United States, that they would give them blacksmiths to repair guns and tools, and would give them gifts worth $10,000. The whites, of course, never upheld the treaty. One wonders who came up with the ridiculous idea of making President James K. Polk approve passes for every settler who wanted to cross into the Indian country. As usual, the Indians were not allowed beyond a certain established line. Whites, meanwhile, clamored forward. Another similar treaty followed in 1850, which the Senate would not ratify, making all of the promises of the Indian office meaningless. The Treaty of 1853 was pure fraud on both sides. This agreement, signed by representatives of the Northern Comanches, Kiowas, and Kiowa Apaches that had no tribal power to agree to anything, allowed the United States to build roads in Indian territory, establish depots and posts, and protect immigrants passing through. As compensation for this, the agents promised goods in the amount of $18,000 annually. The Indians pledged to cease their attacks, both in the United States and Mexico, and to give back all of their captives. Neither side abided by the agreement, nor had they any intention of doing so. The annuity goods were not delivered, though someone in the Indian office undoubtedly made a tidy profit. The Indians, wise perhaps now to the ways of the white man, never had any intention of honoring their promises. They liked the idea of gifts and wanted to see how much they could get. The whites inevitably got something out of these treaties. The Indians could be painted as treaty breakers. They had, after all, signed a document saying they would not raid and would give up captives, and then they had treacherously refused to keep it, notwithstanding that settlers ignored it, as they ignored every other treaty. Manifest destiny, as a notion and as a blueprint for expanding empire, meant that the land, all of it, belonged to the white man. And white men did what they had done ever since they landed in Virginia in the 17th century. They pushed as far into Indian country as their courage or Indian war parties would let them. Imagine the alternative, the U.S. government sending troops to shoot down God-fearing settlers who simply wanted a piece of the American dream. It never happened. The best idea the U.S. government could muster was to put 400 starving Penaticas and 1,000 other mostly Wichita-Cadoan remnants onto reservations on the Brazos River in 1855. The plan was hatched by Jefferson Davis, the new Secretary of War in the Franklin Pierce administration. The Panaticas, decimated by waves of diseases, the game gone from their hunting lands, and their culture polluted by the white invaders, were literally starving to death. The other Indians who remained were simply being overrun. This plan backfired too. The Comanches were given about 20,000 acres on the Clear Fork of the Brazos between present-day Abilene and Wichita Falls. For nomadic hunters, this was an absurdly small plot, too small to raise stock, and mostly impossible to farm. Only about 400 of the remaining 1,200 Panaticas came in. The rest, scared off by rumors that they would be killed, fled north of the Red River with the ubiquitous buffalo hump. For those who stayed, the idea was that they would become happy, well-adjusted farmers. But no Comanche had ever wanted to plant seeds. The Indian agent Robert Neighbors was forced to give them cattle. The reaction of Sanaco, one of the chiefs who came in, sums up the bitter resignation of the Panaticas. "You come into our country and select a small patch of ground around which you run a line and tell us the president will make us a present of this to live on, when everybody knows that the whole of this entire country, from the Red River to the Colorado, is ours and always had been from time immemorial. I suppose, however, if the president tells us to confine ourselves to these narrow limits, we shall be forced to do so." But the main problem with the Texas reservations was the white people who lived next to them. By 1858, white farms and ranches surrounded the reservation. And soon, the whites were blaming the reservation Indians for raids that were being carried out by northern bands. In the fall of 1858, there were a series of savage raids all along the frontier. A settlement 25 miles from Fredericksburg was completely annihilated. Under the leadership of the racist newspaper editor John Baylor, settlers organized themselves and threatened to kill all of the Indians on both reservations. On December 27, 1858, a party of 17 peaceful Indians from the reservation, Anadarkos and Cadoans, were attacked by white men while they slept. The white men fired on them, killing 4 men and 3 women. The 6 men who were guilty of the murders were identified but never charged. The feeling was that no jury would ever convict them and that their arrest might stir the border into full-scale revolt. Meanwhile, Baylor continued to stir up trouble, even going so far as to say that he would kill any soldier who tried to stand in his way. By the spring of 1859, the area around the reservations was in full panic. Groups of whites went about armed and looking for Indians. In May, some whites opened fire on a group of Indians. There was little doubt now that if the Indians stayed there, there would be a full-scale war, or more likely, a full-scale slaughter. On July 31st, Agent Neighbors and 3 companies of federal troops led a long, strange, and colorful procession of Indians, all of them except the hostile Comanches, out of the Brazos reservations, never to return. The sight was at once magnificent and pathetic. There were 384 Comanches and 1,112 Indians from the other tribes. They moved in a slow procession in the shimmering heat of the prairie, dragging their travoy behind them, as they had for hundreds of years. They crossed the Red River on August 8th, and on August 16th, arrived at their new reservation on the Washita River, near present-day Fort Cobb, Oklahoma. The next day, Agent Neighbors returned to Texas to file a report. While he was at Fort Belknap, a man named Edward Cornett, who disagreed with his Indian policies, walked up to him and shot him in the back. By almost any measure, John Salmon Rip Ford was one of the West's most remarkable characters. He was at various times a medical doctor, a newspaper editor, a state representative and state senator, a flamboyant proponent of the Confederacy, and an explorer who blazed the San Antonio to El Paso Trail, which later bore his name. He served as mayor of Brownsville, delegate to the 1875 Constitutional Convention, and superintendent of the state's deaf and dumb school. He was a peacekeeper, too. He once protected the Brazos Reservation Indians against false accusations from the local whites, but later refused to arrest the men responsible for killing the innocent Cadoans and Anadarkos, in spite of an order by a state district judge to do so. Rip Ford was a man of many opinions, all of them strong. But he was most famous as a fighter of Indians and Mexicans. He had joined Jack Hayes's upstart Rangers in 1836, rising to the rank of first lieutenant. He served under Hayes again as his adjutant during the Mexican War, where he earned his nickname. It was his job to send death notices to soldiers' families, and he often included the postscript, "Rest in peace." Since he ended up writing so many such reports, he shortened the message to R.I.P. Many people believed the initials stood for all of the Indians he had killed. After the war, he rejoined the Rangers, was promoted to captain, and spent time on the border hunting Mexican bandits and Indians. Though he was literate and cultured, he was a hard-looking man. You could imagine him in a cold camp in the limestone breaks of the hill country, with Hayes and McCulloch and the others, waking in a frozen dawn to track and kill Comanches. He had a broad face with deep-set eyes, a crooked nose, jug-handle ears, and a thin, hard mouth. He liked to wear buckskins and a long and narrowly cut beard. Sometimes he wore a stovepipe hat. He was known to be a hard drill master. In January 1858, as Texas reeled from a fresh wave of Comanche attacks in Erath, Brown, and Comanche counties, Ford became the duly appointed savior of the frontier. Texas had had enough of the federal government's staggering incompetence and of its utter failure to stop Indian attacks. The last straw had been the Army's decision in 1857 to ship a large part of the federal troops in Texas, most of the 2nd Cavalry, north to Utah to quell a Mormon revolt. The Comanches had understood this perfectly and had stepped up their raids. That was enough. Texans would take matters into their own hands. The sum of $70,000 was appropriated, and 100 men were recruited for six-month terms of service. Ford, who accepted a commission as senior ranger captain, would command them. Their mission was highly unusual. In recent years, every significant military expedition against the Comanches had been mounted in response to specific attacks. The idea had been to pursue the raiders and punish them for what they had done. It was pure retribution. Ford and his men were to simply launch themselves north of the Red River, penetrate deep into Comanche territory, and strike an offensive blow. "I impress upon you the necessity of action and energy," Texas Governor Hardin Runnels told Ford. "Follow any and all trails of hostile or suspected hostile Indians you may discover, and if possible, overtake and chastise them, if unfriendly." Runnels' words sounded simple enough. In fact, he was calling for open war against Indians in direct defiance of federal policy. The orders harkened back to what Jack Hayes had done 20 years earlier when he roamed the hill country looking for Indians, attacking whatever Indians he found. It no longer mattered to Texans if the Rangers had caught any Indians in criminal acts. The point was to strike them hard and preemptively. The point was that they could and would be pursued to deep within their homelands, to their very lodges. Thus was Ford unleashed. He recruited the best men he could find, armed them each with two revolvers and a rifle, and drilled them on marksmanship and tactics. They were going to do things the old Ranger way, the unpleasant, hard, and uncomfortable way, the Hayes way. He added 113 friendly Indians to his force, mostly Tonkawas under their chief Placido, and Caddos and Anadarkos under Jim Pockmark. There were even some Shawnees. Like Hayes, Ford made extensive use of Indians, writing later that they were men of more than ordinary intellect who possessed minute information concerning the geography and topography of that country. On April 29, 1858, riding behind a wide screen of Indian flankers and scouts, spies in the vernacular of the day, Ford and his cohort splashed across the Red River, threading their way through large stretches of pure quicksand. The fact that they had absolutely no lawful authority outside of Texas did not seem to bother them. On May 10th, their scouts brought in two arrowheads, which were quickly identified by the Indians as Cotsutica Comanche. On May 11th, they discovered a small Comanche camp on the Canadian River. Ford had moved like a ranger, quietly, building few or no campfires, sending scouts out for 20 miles in four directions. And in the ranger company, there was, of course, none of the fuss and feathers and repeated bugling that characterized the Army expeditions. The Army was learning the old ranger lessons, but only slowly. The Federal troopers still moved with startling obviousness across the prairie. On May 12th, Ford's Tonkawas attacked and quickly destroyed the camp, killing several Indians and taking others prisoner. Two Comanches escaped at full gallop, heading toward the Canadian River. The Rangers and reservation Indians followed, chasing the Indians at high speed for 3 miles. They galloped across the Canadian River and soon drew up in front of a large Cotsutica camp that ran for a mile along a creek. It was a lovely piece of ground, a pure, clear stream flowing into a river valley. Beyond the northern bank rose the picturesque Antelope Hills, bathed in the light of the sunrise. This was deep in Comanche territory, where they did not expect to be attacked. What they were looking at was not just a mobile war camp, but a full-scale village, with women and children and buffalo meat drying on racks in front of the teepees. Ford's 213 men were now confronting 400 Cotsutica warriors. Ford sent his Indian cohort first, the idea being, as he put it, to make the Comanches believe that they had only Indians and bows and arrows to contend against. The ploy apparently worked. The main Comanche chief, Pobishikwaso, Iron Jacket, emerged from the swirling masses of horsemen and rode forward. Iron Jacket was not just a war chief, he was also a great medicine man. Instead of buckskin, he wore iron mail, an ancient piece of Spanish armor. He carried a bow and a lance, wore a headdress decorated with feathers and long red flannel streamers, and was elaborately smeared with paint. His horse, according to Ford, was gloriously caparisoned. As he rode forward, he summoned his big magic, walking his horse in a circle and then expelling his breath with great force. He was said to be able to blow arrows away from their targets. Bullets and arrows were said to bounce off him. Iron Jacket was said to be invincible. And indeed, for a little while, he seemed to be. Rangers and Indians shot at him, to no effect. One participant recalled that pistol rounds would glance off his armor like hail from a tin roof. He circled again and moved forward, but now Ford's Indians, who were armed with six-shooters and Mississippi rifles, found their mark. About 6 rifle shots rang on the air, wrote Ford. The chief's horse jumped about 6 feet straight up and fell. Another barrage followed, and the Comanche medicine man was no more. The effect was predictable and immediate. The Comanches in the main camp made a brief stand and then fled, demoralized by their chief's broken magic. What followed was a running fight that featured Rangers and their Indian allies with far superior weaponry picking off Cotsutica riders on the open plain and in the wooded river bottom. The battle extended to an area 3 miles by 6 miles and soon turned into a series of single combats, in which the Rangers, with reloadable 45 caliber six-shooters and breech-loading carbines, held an enormous advantage of the bow and lance-wielding Comanches. The latter did have guns, but they were old single-shot muskets that could be discharged only once. The Indians fought valiantly. Much of their fighting was meant to try to cover the retreat of their women and children. Women were killed along with the men. Ford makes a point of noting that it was not an easy matter to distinguish Indian warriors from squaws, meaning that the Rangers did not knowingly kill women. This was not really true. Women could ride as well as the men and were extremely adept with a bow. They were often killed as combatants, as would be true 100 years later in the Vietnam War, and in any case, were always potential combatants. Needless to say, the Tonkawas and Shawnees and other Indians had no such compunctions about killing women. Plains warfare was a fight to the death, always. In the running fight, 76 Comanches were killed, and many more were wounded. The Rangers suffered only 2 dead and 3 wounded. The numbers of dead friendly Indians were never reported. Now something very strange happened. Another force of Comanches, as large or larger than the first, emerged over the ravines and thicket to confront Ford's men. According to legend, it was commanded by Pita Nocona, but there is no hard evidence for that. What followed was ancient, ritual combat of the sort that few white men had ever seen. Comanches in full regalia rode forth individually onto the plain, screaming taunts at the reservation Indians and daring them to come out in single combat. This they did. "A scene was now enacted, beggaring description," wrote Ford. "It reminded one of the rude and chivalrous days of knight-errantry. Shields and lances and bows and headdresses, prancing steeds and many minutiae were not wanting to compile the resemblance. And when the combatants rushed at each other with defiant shouts, nothing save the piercing report of the rifle varied the affair from a battlefield of the Middle Ages. Half an hour was spent in this, without much damage to either party. Then the modern era quickly reasserted itself. The Rangers charged, en masse, guns blazing, and the Comanche line soon broke. There was a running fight of some 3 miles, ending with no casualties on either side. Ford's horses were exhausted. The Comanches hauled themselves off to lick their wounds. The fight was over. Ford's fight became known in Texas history as the Battle of Antelope Hills, and it was famous for several reasons. It reasserted the superiority of Texans against Comanches and underscored the incompetence of the Army and the Indian Office. It sealed Rip Ford's fame and, most important, proved the lesson that Jack Hayes had learned but that had somehow gotten lost over the years. The Comanches, Ford later wrote to Runnels, can be followed, overtaken, and beaten, provided the pursuers will be laborious, vigilant, and are willing to undergo privations. Willing, in short, to behave and fight like the Rangers of the late 1830s and early 1840s. The Battle of Antelope Hills also brought into focus the rather thorny political question of who was better qualified to patrol the borderlands, Federals or Texans. On the floor of the U.S. Senate that year, Sam Houston had risen to say, with withering scorn, that Texas no longer wanted federal troops at all. "Give us 1,000 Rangers, and we will be responsible for the defense of our frontier. Texas does not want regular troops. Withdraw them, if you please." He was countered by Mississippi Senator Jefferson Davis, Secretary of War, who reminded Houston of the disciplinary problems the Army had experienced with the Rangers in the Mexican War. "If the general had gone further," he retorted, "and said that irregular cavalry, Rangers, always produce disturbance in the neighborhood of a camp, he would have said no more than my experience would confirm." But Ford's raid had stung the Army deeply. It had suggested, or perhaps proven, that Houston was right. Ford had done what no one in the U.S. Army had ever done, which was to pursue Comanches into their home ranges. Thus was the 2nd Cavalry summoned from its labors in Utah to make its own march north of the Red River against the Comanches. The expedition was political from start to finish. Ford's raid had prompted the U.S. Army commander in Texas, the chubby, profane General David Twiggs, to obtain authority directly from Army headquarters at West Point to abandon the passive defense policy the Army had been forced to put up with since 1849. A punitive force was thus organized at Fort Belknap under the command of the dapper, blonde, egotistical Mississippian Earl Van Dorn, who would later find fame as a Confederate major general. With 5 companies of troops, and 135 friendly Indians, under the command of the wiry, ambitious 20-year-old college student Sol Ross, they rode north on September 15, 1858. They were tracking Buffalo Hump, the seemingly indestructible Panatica chief who had refused to go on the reservation and now rode with other Comanche bands. Their Wichita scouts soon found a large village of Comanches next to a village of Wichitas. The Indians were completely unaware of the danger. The reason they were unaware of danger is that they had just concluded a treaty with a Captain Prince, the commanding army officer at Fort Arbuckle, which was located just to the east. While the intrepid Van Dorn was at Fort Belknap, making ready to strike the Comanches a death blow, Prince was hobnobbing and making peace with the chiefs of the same band, Buffalo Hump, hair bobbed on one side, and Over the Buttes. Neither Van Dorn nor Prince had any idea what the other was doing. Pleased with what seemed to be at least a temporary peace and freedom from worry about attacks like the one Rip Ford had made, the Wichitas and Comanches were feasting, trading, gambling, and generally carrying on. They were completely aware of the approach of the Bluecoats and friendlies under Van Dorn and Ross. Several reports on their location and strength were given to Hair Bobbed on one side, who considered the matter and concluded that the white man would never attack them, having just made a treaty with them. The omens were good. They were safe. They went to sleep. At dawn the next morning, Van Dorn's troops attacked the Comanche village with a vengeance. Ross and his reserve Indians had run off the horses, so most of the warriors were forced to fight on foot. It was more of a massacre than a fight. 200 blue-coated troops were in the village, blasting away into the teepees, while the Indians frantically tried, as they always did, to cover the retreat of their families. 70 Indians were killed, untold numbers wounded. Buffalo Hump managed to escape with most of his warriors. The Rangers lost 4 killed and 12 wounded, including Van Dorn, with an arrow through his navel, and Ross with 2 bullet wounds. Both men had to stay on the field of battle for 5 days to recuperate. The army burned 120 teepees, along with all the Comanche ammunition, cooking utensils, clothing, dressed skins, corn, and subsistence stores. Those who escaped had only the clothing on their back, and many were afoot, since the soldiers had captured 300 horses, too. Though what had been perpetrated upon the Comanches amounted to a cruel trick, the army boasted a glorious victory. The Texas press wasn't so sure. One paper expressed the opinion that the effect of what became known as the Battle of the Wichita Village will probably be a cessation of depredations upon the border settlements for a time at least, but insisted that an end of the war should be the blow followed by active, energetic operations. The latter did not happen anytime soon. On November 5, 1858, barely 7 weeks later, Sol Ross himself noted that, since the battle, Comanches had stolen more than 100 head of horses from settlements in northern Texas. The violent Indian raids of the fall of 1858, which had set off John Baylor's Reservation War, came at least in part in reprisal for Van Dorn's attack. Still, there was a clear meaning in both Ford's and Van Dorn's attacks. They were unambiguously offensive, for one thing. They showed a willingness, for the first time, to cross the Red River in pursuit of Comanches, and they showed that such tactics could at least kill Indians. Whether they could stop raiding remained to be seen. They also showed that advances in weaponry, especially the six-shooter and the breech-loading carbine, had radically altered the basic balance of power. When 200 men could take on and devastate a Comanche force twice their size, there was a lesson to be learned. Jack Hayes, of course, had demonstrated this in 1844 at Walker's Creek. But nobody remembered that now. 12. White Queen of the Comanches. Even in one of the bloodiest years on the frontier, the killing of Martha Sherman stood out. Maybe it was because she had been gang-raped and tortured while she was pregnant. Maybe it was because of her dead baby, or because the precise, horrific details of what happened to her, which she herself related in the few days she lived, spread so quickly in Parker, Jack, and other counties. Whatever the case, in the days following the Sherman raid, all hell broke loose. People panicked. They fled the frontier as fast as they could. "The indications are," wrote 28-year-old schoolteacher Jonathan Hamilton Baker in his diary on November 28th, "that our county will soon be depopulated." Caravans were moving. The counties were emptying. Within days of the raid, there were 100 deserted farms in the area. Most of the people west of Weatherford had retreated eastward, leaving, in the words of one rancher, "the extreme frontier post." Yet not everyone was leaving. A 24-year-old named Charles Goodnight, destined to become one of the most famous cattlemen in Texas and one of the originators of the great cattle drives, rode through the chill, rainy night, recruiting a posse to pursue the raiders. He found 8 willing men who met the next morning at the house of an old man named Isaac Lynn, whose daughter and son-in-law had recently been brutally murdered by Comanches. When Goodnight entered the house, he found Lynn sitting before a large log fire in the old-fashioned fireplace with a long forked dogwood stick on which was an Indian scalp thoroughly salted. The hair was tucked inside. As he turned it carefully over the fire, the grease oozed out of it. He looked back over his shoulder, bade me good morning, and then turned to his work of roasting the scalp. I do not think I ever saw so sad a face. Since his daughter's death, he had become a collector of scalps and asked people to bring him any they had. He roasted them so they wouldn't spoil. Like so many people on the bleeding frontier, he was drowning in hatred and grief. Goodnight and his men left immediately to track Peta Nocona's raiders. Because the Indians were traveling with 150 stolen horses, this was easily done. The Comanches, who normally took pains to avoid being tracked, scattering their herds when they came to gravel, rock, or hard ground, were soon well beyond where white men had ever followed them before. And so they stopped taking precautions and, in Goodnight's words, were driving in a body. Goodnight and his party had traveled at least 120 miles across open prairies and swift, cold rivers. It had rained incessantly. They were without food or bedding, and now they realized they were approaching a camp with a large number of Indians, many more than had been with Peta Nocona's raiders. This was Nautas Village on Mule Creek, the great supply depot and clearinghouse for the frontier raids. Satisfied that they knew where the Indians had gone, and aware that they had no chance against so many of them, Goodnight and his trackers turned back. A full-scale expedition was quickly mounted. By the time it coalesced at Fort Belknap on December 13th, it consisted of 40 Rangers, 21 Army soldiers from the 2nd Cavalry at Fort Cooper, and some 70 local volunteers, including Goodnight as scout. They were commanded by 23-year-old Sul Ross, the wiry, ambitious young man who had recruited Indian scouts for the Van Dorn expedition while still an undergraduate at Wesleyan University in Florence, Alabama. Ross had fought bravely at the Battle of Antelope Hills and had been gravely wounded, and had thus made a name for himself. He had been chosen personally by Governor Sam Houston to replace the incompetent and love-struck Middleton Johnson, under whom Ross had served. Ross's commission would turn out to be a brilliant move for both men and convince people that Houston was doing something about the Comanche problem. Ross would use it as the springboard to a dazzling career. He later became the youngest general in the Confederacy, a popular 2-term governor of Texas, and president of the Agricultural and Mechanical College of Texas, now Texas A&M. For the moment, plenty of people hated him, especially John Baylor's rabble-rousers, who saw him as an Indian sympathizer and threatened to hang him if they found him. Ross himself had higher purposes. In a letter written later that contained more than a hint of vainglory, he wrote, "I determined to make a desperate attempt to curb the insolence of these implacable enemies of Texas. I planned to accomplish this by following them into their fastness, and carry the war into their own homes, where this tribe, the most inveterate raiders on the border, retired with their captives and booty to their wild haunts amid the hills and valleys of the beautiful Canadian and Peace Rivers. One can almost hear the campaign speeches and slogans stirring in his brain. The cavalcade headed northwest in bitter cold, over mesquite prairies scarred by ravines and limestone ridges. This was open country, dun-colored and wintry. The young schoolteacher Baker, who joined the volunteers, later recalled poor prairie uplands with tolerably good valleys along the creeks where the grass was fine. There was no timber along our route today except small hackberries in the valleys and scrubby mesquite on the prairies. They saw thousands of buffalo. The water of the Big Wichita and Peace Rivers was salty and jippy and tasted awful. At night, there were heavy frosts. The men wrapped themselves in blankets and buffalo robes and shivered before small fires. They crossed rivers in the tracks of the buffalo to avoid quicksand. On December 17th came rain, dense fog, and briefly warmer air. On December 18th, there were thunderstorms in the night. The next morning, Goodnight found a pillow slip with a little girl's belt and Martha Sherman's Bible in it. Why had the Indians made a point of taking the Bible? According to Goodnight, Comanche shields, made of two layers of the toughest rawhide from the neck of a buffalo and hardened in fire, were almost invulnerable to bullets when stuffed with paper. When Comanches robbed houses, they invariably took all the books they could find. On December 19th, the Rangers and soldiers from the 2nd Cavalry, riding out ahead of the volunteers in a long valley bounded by a range of sandhills, spotted the Indian camp Charles Goodnight and his scouts had seen. They were lucky. A blustery norther had come up, of the sort the plains were famous for, and the soldiers' position was concealed by blowing clouds of sand. There were not many Indians in the camp. The 500 that Goodnight had theorized were no longer there. The few they could see were packing horses and mules and preparing to leave, unaware of the approach of the white men. Seeing this, Ross ordered the army sergeant to circle around to the other side of the camp to block the Indians' retreat. Then he and his 60 men attacked what was later determined to be 15 Indians. Many of the latter were killed before they even picked up weapons. Others fled into the jaws of the trap and were cut down there. Once among them, the men realized that most of the occupants of the camp were women. There were a few old men, too, and a few warriors. In Goodnight's account, the Rangers spared most, but not all, of the women they encountered. The Federal troops, meanwhile, killed everyone they encountered, regardless of sex. As Goodnight described it, the sergeant and his men from the 2nd Cavalry fell in behind on the squaws, six or eight in number, who never got across the first bend of the creek. They were so heavily loaded with meat, tent poles, and camp equipage that their horses could not run. We suppose they had about 1,000 pounds of buffalo meat in various stages of curing. The sergeant and his men killed every one of them, nearly in a pile. The fight lasted only a few minutes and was more of a butchery than a pitched battle. Participants remembered some interesting details. The few warriors in the camp used their horses for breastworks, standing behind them when they were on their feet and lying down behind them after they were shot down. In the midst of the struggle, the white soldiers found themselves under attack from 15 or so dogs from the Indian camp, who tried valiantly to defend their Indian masters. Almost all were shot and killed. The battle ended in a brief running fight. Ross and Lieutenant Tom Kelleher rode in pursuit of the last three Indians, who were mounted on two horses. After a mile, they caught up with the single Indian, who rode a splendid iron-gray stallion. Ross was about to shoot when the Comanche, who he could now see was carrying a small child, reined in the horse and, depending on which version you believe, either opened her robe to show her breasts or cried, "Americano! Americano!" She may have done both. In any case, Her ploy worked. Ross did not shoot. He ordered Kelleher to stay with her and the child, while Ross took off after the other two riders. He soon caught them and fired his army colt, hitting the rear rider, who also turned out to be a woman. As she fell, she dragged the main rider to the ground with her. He was a large man, fully armed. From his earlier behavior and the way he had barked commands, Ross had identified him as the main chief, and he looked the part. He was nude to the waist, his body streaked with bright pigments. He wore two eagle plumes in his hair, a disc of beaten gold around his neck, embossed with a turtle, broad gold bands on his upper arms, and fawn-skin leggings trimmed out with scalp locks. He managed to land on his feet, seized his bow, and loosed several arrows. The following is Ross's account of what happened next. "My horse, running at full speed, was very nearly up on top of the man when he was struck with an arrow which caused him to begin pitching or bucking, and it was with great difficulty that I kept my saddle, and in the meantime narrowly escaped several arrows coming in quick succession from the chief's bow. He would have killed me but for a random shot from my pistol, which broke his right arm at the elbow, completely disabling him. My horse then became quiet, and I shot the chief twice through the body, whereupon he deliberately walked to a small tree, the only one in sight, and leaning against it, began to sing a wild, weird song. As he seemed to prefer death to life, I directed the Mexican boy to end his misery by a charge of buckshot." Other accounts suggest a slightly more complex drama in which Ross and the chief conversed through an interpreter, the chief insisting that when I am dead, I will surrender, but not before, and even trying to throw a spear at Ross with his good arm. Either way, the Indian was soon dead. A man named Anton Martinez, Ross's manservant, who had been a child captive of the Comanches, and who said he had been a slave in Pita Nakona's own family, identified him as Pita Nakona. The final tally? 12 Indians dead, 3 captured. The third was a 9-year-old Comanche boy. The loss to the Comanches, who were hunkering down into their winter camps, was stunning. 69 pack mule loads of buffalo meat, something more than 15,000 pounds of it, and 370 horses. Now Ross rode back to the place where Kelleher held the woman and her child captive. The woman was filthy, covered with dirt and grease from handling so much bloody buffalo meat. But to Ross's astonishment, he noticed that she had blue eyes, and he saw that under the grime, her short-cropped hair was lighter in color than Indian black. She was white. Not quite believing what they had found, they took her back to what was left of her village, which the soldiers were busily looting. They were also scalping the dead Indians, men and women alike. By now, scalping was the common practice on both sides. Since two men claimed the scalp of Pita Nakona, they decided to split it into two parts. The white squaw was then taken back to where Pita Nakona had been killed. She wept and wailed. The soldiers did not let her stay there. They brought her to the main battlefield, where she was allowed to walk among the mutilated dead, carrying her child. She muttered in Comanche as she went, and wailed loudly only when she came to one young warrior who had white features. When Martinez, who spoke Comanche, asked her who he was, the woman replied cryptically, "He's my boy, and he's not my boy." She later explained that he was the son of another white girl who had been captured by the Comanches and married an Indian. She had died, but had asked Nata to look after the boy as though he were her own son. She then told the Mexican how she had come to be there. In Ranger Frank Golson's account, she was with her two boys, whom the translator identified as Quana and Grassnut, when the Rangers attacked. They fled, along with other women and children. "After I had gone some distance," she told Martinez, "I missed both of my boys. I came back in search of them, coming as near the battle as I could. In this way, I was caught. I am greatly distressed about my boys. I fear they are killed." Ross, whose men had killed no one of that description, assured her that they were alive. She continued to weep. This was, after all, the second time in 24 years that she had seen people close to her massacred and scalped. The second time she had been taken captive by an alien culture whose language she did not speak. Through Martinez, she told Ross that she remembered that her father had been killed in a battle long ago, and that she and her brother had been captured. That and other details convinced Ross that she might be the long-lost Cynthia Ann Parker. With that, she stopped talking. According to Golson, she also gave them a lot of trouble trying to escape. At some point, Jonathan Baker noticed a tiny, elaborately beaded moccasin on the ground. He picked it up and was looking at it when he noticed that Nauta was watching him closely. He then realized that the child was missing a shoe. The little girl toddled over to him, and he gave her the moccasin. Nauta lived a hard life, but she had found the time and energy to make this exquisite little shoe. The next day, the men burned everything they could not carry and rode out. They took her back to Fort Belknap and thence to Fort Cooper, where she was delivered into the care of the captain's wife. A ranger named A.B. Mason, who accompanied her on that trip, recalled that after she arrived, she sat for a time immovable, lost in profound meditation, oblivious to everything by which she was surrounded, ever and anon convulsed, as it were, by some powerful emotion which she struggled to suppress. Mason wrote a version of what Cynthia Ann told officials at Fort Cooper in the February 5, 1861 issue of the Galveston Civilian. His piece was undoubtedly edited, but this is how he quoted her. "I remember when I was a little girl, being a long time at the house with the picket fence all around. One day some Indians came to the house. They had a white rag on a stick. My father went out to talk to them. They surrounded and killed him. Then many other Indians came and fought at the house. Several whites were killed. My mother and her 4 children were taken prisoner. In the evening, mother and 2 of her children were retaken by a white man. My brother died among the Indians of smallpox. I lived with the Indians north of Santa Fe. I have 3 children. She was wrong about her father talking to the Indians. It was her uncle Benjamin. And she was wrong about her brother John dying of smallpox. He was ransomed back to his family in September 1842. But her memory was extremely accurate about everything else. She may have been confused by the fury of the raid, but she remembered it quite clearly. She remembered watching her father die." Ross sent immediately for Cynthia Ann's uncle, Isaac Parker. The women of Fort Cooper, meanwhile, decided to clean the filthy woman up, an enterprise that offered some comic relief amid the tragedy. They found some clothes for her, then got an old Negro mammy to scrub her down with soap and hot water. Then they combed her hair and let her look at herself in the mirror. "She submitted to all this willingly enough, apparently," wrote Golson in his memoir, "until she got a good opportunity to get out of the door of the place. When this opportunity occurred, she made a dive for the door and got past the Negro mammy. Then she headed for her tent, which was 200 or 300 yards away, tearing her clothes off as she ran until she had almost nothing on, followed by the mammy frantically waving a washcloth as 3 bewildered army wives looked on, and the child toddled along after them with nobody paying much attention to her. Nauta reached her tent, where she managed to find and put on some Comanche clothing. After that, the army wives gave up trying to pretty her up. When Isaac Parker arrived, the captive was seated on a pine box with her elbows on her knees and her head in her hands. She paid no attention to the assembled men until Parker spoke her name. With that, she stood, looked directly at him, patted her breast, and said, 'Me, Cincy Ann.' She repeated it, then resumed her seat. She agreed to answer questions about the raid on Parker's fort. She got some of the details wrong, but she remembered correctly that there were 5 captives, 2 grown women, and 3 children. Then she was asked to describe Parker's fort. She responded by using a stick to draw an outline, using dots and dashes. She then drank from the canteen and dribbled water to round out the portrait, which included the stream that ran behind the fort. "Gentlemen," Isaac Parker said, "I actually could not make as good a picture of the old fort as she has made." The Battle of Peas River, as this very small skirmish came to be known rather grandiosely, has long been regarded by Texans as a major historical event. The return of the legendary White Squaw offered what was to whites a completely satisfying ending to the great epic tale. Poor Cynthia Ann, the girl who had descended into pagan savagery, was back at last in the arms of her loving and God-fearing family. For the next century, the amazing tale of Cynthia Ann Parker's Comanche captivity would be taught to school children in Texas. There were some interesting sequels to the battle as well, with enormous implications for the future of the Comanche tribe. Quanah and his brother survived it. After the fight, Goodnight realized that two Indians had left on horseback. The young ranger and 10 scouts tracked them to a Comanche camp in the Panhandle. Though Goodnight never learned their identity, the riders were almost certainly Quanah and Peanuts. The other child involved in the fight, the 9-year-old Comanche boy, was adopted by Sol Ross and his wife. They named him Peas. He was General Ross's horse tender in 135 Civil War engagements, married a former slave, became a respectable citizen of Waco, and died in 1883. The fight also came to be seen, incorrectly, as the turning point in the war against the Comanches. "Thus was fought the great battle of Peas River," intoned one of the breathless historical accounts of the day, "with the great Comanche chief, Pitanocona, with a strong force on one side, and the brave Captain Ross with 60 rangers on the other. In the fight, the greater part of the warriors were killed, and such a victory never before had been gained over these Comanches." In Ross's own description, the battle takes on nearly mythic proportions. "The fruits of this important victory can never be computed in dollars and cents," he wrote later. "The great Comanche Confederacy was forever broken. The blow was decisive. Their illustrious chief slept with his fathers, and with him were most of his doughty warriors." This was utter nonsense. Comanche raids in 1864, to take just one year, were the worst in history. 1871 and 1872 were bad years, too. The U.S. Army sent 3,000 soldiers against the Comanches in 1874, the largest army ever sent to hunt down hostile Indians. Though Ross had shown great personal courage in his hand-to-hand combat with Pitanocona, the Indian foes in the Battle of Peas River were mostly women who were shot down while trying to escape on heavily laden horses. "I was in the Peas River fight," wrote H.B. Rogers in a memoir, "but I am not very proud of it. That was not a battle at all, but just a killing of squaws. 1 or 2 bucks and 16 squaws were killed. The Indians were getting ready to leave when we came upon them." In the weeks and months that followed, the battle received wide coverage in Texas newspapers. None of them bothered to mention who the victims were. Considering the anti-Indian hysteria of the moment, it is unlikely that anyone really cared. What is interesting is the virtually universal belief among Texans at the time that Sol Ross, the hero of the battle and the future governor, had saved the poor, unfortunate Cynthia Ann Parker from an ugly fate. That belief would color the histories for a long, long time. We will never know how Cynthia Ann Parker felt in the weeks and months after her capture by Sol Ross. There are so few comparable events in American history. But it was painfully apparent from the earliest days that the real tragedy in her life was not her first captivity, but her second. White men never quite grasped this. The event that destroyed her life was not the raid at Parker's Fort in 1836, but her miraculous and much-celebrated rescue at Mule Creek in 1860. The latter killed her husband, separated her forever from her beloved sons, and deposited her in a culture where she was more a true captive than she had ever been with the Comanches. In the moments before Ross's raid, she had been quite as primitive as any other Plains Indian. Packing thousands of pounds of buffalo meat onto mules, covered from head to toe in blood and grease, literally immersed in this elemental world that never quite left the Stone Age, a world of ceaseless toil, hunger, constant war, and early death. But also of pure magic, of beaver ceremonies and eagle dances, of spirits that inhabited springs, trees, rocks, turtles, and crows. A place where people danced all night and sang bear medicine songs, where wolf medicine made a person invulnerable to bullets, dream visions dictated tribal policy, and ghosts were alive in the wind. On grassy plains and timbered river bottoms from Kansas to Texas, Cynthia Ann, Nauta, had drifted in the mystical cycles of the seasons, living in that random, terrifying, bloody, and intensely alive place where nature and divinity became one. And then, suddenly, all of it disappeared. Instead of Stone Age camps, a swirl in magic and taboo, and scented smoke from Mesquite Lodge fires, she found herself sitting on taffeta chairs in drawing rooms on the outer margins of the Industrial Revolution, being interrogated by polite, uncomprehending white men who believed in a single God and in a supremely rational universe where everything could be explained. This new culture was every bit as alien as the one she confronted after the attack on Parker's Fort. It was as though she had walked yet again through a door into another world, quite as complete as the one she had left, and yet, in all of its mystifying details, completely different. Isaac Parker quickly satisfied himself that the woman Ross had captured was his long-lost niece, Cynthia Ann. He decided immediately that he would take her and her daughter Prairie Flower back home with him to Birdville, now Haltom City, just north of Fort Worth. Both of her parents were dead. Silas had, of course, perished in the raid on Parker's Fort. Her mother, Lucy, had died in 1852 after a life filled with bad marriages, three after Silas, poor health, and a brutal 5-year legal battle over her husband's estate. Cynthia Ann's brother, Silas Jr., and sister, Orlena, having survived a rough childhood, Cynthia Ann, ironically, probably had a better life, were married and living in Texas. But it was Silas's brother Isaac who decided to take his niece in. Cynthia Ann's uncle James, the old searcher, was still alive, but curiously absent in all of this. Perhaps he gave up when he heard that she did not want to be rescued. They soon departed, accompanied by the former Comanche captive Anton Martinez, who acted as interpreter, along with two rangers. They stopped on the way at Fort Belknap, where a more successful effort was made to clean the mother and daughter up, and where Prairie Flower played happily with other children. She was, by all accounts, a bumptious and sprightly child. She was dark-skinned and strikingly pretty. Everyone liked her. Cynthia Ann herself was sturdily built, with short-cropped, medium-brown hair, wide-set, strikingly light blue eyes, and a mouth that seemed set in anger or resignation, or both. She was not pretty, nor was she especially unattractive. In calico, she looked in most ways like a typical Anglo pioneer woman of the day, a bit stout, and rather more worn-looking than her urban counterparts at a comparable age. She was also, recognizably, a Parker. One account put her at 5'7" and 140 pounds, which would have made her a giant among Comanche women. She and her tall, muscular husband must have cut quite a figure in Comanche camps, just as her son Quanah would later on. They passed through Weatherford, the seat of Parker County, where the worst of Peta Nakona's raids had taken place, and then stopped in Fort Worth, where Cynthia Ann became an instant celebrity. It is not known why the travelers stopped here. Some accounts say it was to have a photograph taken, but the first known photograph of her, a tintype actually, was not taken until a month later in Austin. Whatever the reason, her arrival caused a great commotion, as residents of Tarrant County, who totaled 6,020 that year, clamored to see the famous white squaw and her child. Her arrival was considered such an important event that the local children were let out of school. They came in groups to gawk at the terrified captives, who were on display in front of a general store in downtown Fort Worth. It was a sort of freak show. Cynthia Ann was bound with rope and set out atop a large box so that everyone could see her. One can only wonder what role her Uncle Isaac, politician that he was, played in it. According to one witness, she was not dressed in Indian costume, but wore a torn calico dress. Her hair was bronzed by the sun. Her face was tanned, and she made a pathetic figure as she stood there, viewing the crowds that swarmed about her. The tears were streaming down her face, and she was muttering in the Indian language. Texans could not get enough of her. There were many newspaper accounts of her return, all of which were uniformly obsessed with the idea that a pretty little 9-year-old white girl from a devout Baptist family had been transformed into a pagan savage who had mated with a redskin and borne his children and who had forgotten her mother tongue. She was thus, according to the morals of the day, grotesquely compromised. She had forsaken the virtues of Christianity for the wanton immorality of the Indian. That was the attraction, and all the stories assumed that everything she had done had been forced upon her, that she had suffered grievous mistreatment, had been whipped and beaten, and had led a lonely and desperate existence. People simply did not believe that a Christian white woman had gone along with it voluntarily. One paper, the Clarksville Northern Standard, observed later that her body and arms bear the marks of having been cruelly treated. Yet there is nothing to suggest that she was cruelly treated after the first few days of her captivity, as her cousin Rachel Plummer had described them. She was the ward of a chief, later his wife. The scars may have resulted from the practice among Comanche women of cutting themselves in mourning, often on the arms and breasts. Apparently, no white people wanted to think too hard about the implications of the lovely mixed-race girl named Prairie Flower, whom her mother obviously adored. After the carnival interlude in town, the party continued to Birdville. Here Isaac lived in a spacious double log cabin that was considered for many years the finest house in Tarrant County. It is not clear exactly what he thought he was going to accomplish with Cynthia Ann and her daughter. Perhaps he was simply doing what he considered to be his family duty. Perhaps he saw himself as her deliverer, imagining the day when Cynthia Ann, grateful and weeping, would embrace Jesus and forsake her savage ways. Nothing of the sort happened. Cynthia Ann's repatriation was, in fact, a disaster. She was not only unrepentant, she was actively and incessantly hostile to her captors. She tried repeatedly to escape with her daughter, sometimes making it far into the woods and requiring a search party to find her. She was so intent on leaving that Isaac had to lock her in the house when he was away. As her legal guardian, he was empowered to do so. Cynthia Ann was being treated as though she were crazy. An entirely free white woman, 33 years old and from a prominent family, was being forcibly restrained so that she could not return to her sons and the culture that raised her. Her family believed that, owing to a life in which they assumed she had been sexually abused and beaten and enslaved, she was unable to know what was best for her. Cynthia Ann, meanwhile, always had a clear and quite correct sense of her own interests. Such treatment must have been terrible to endure. She could not, or would not, speak English, though in any case what she remembered would have been rudimentary. She would sit for hours and hours on the wide porch of Isaac's house, weeping and nursing Prairie Flower. She refused to stop her pagan devotions. One of her relatives described her ritual of worship. She went out to a smooth place on the ground, cleaned it off very nicely, and made a circle and a cross. On the cross she built a fire, burned some tobacco, and then cut a place on her breast and let the blood drop onto the fire. She then lit her pipe and blowed smoke toward the sun and assumed an attitude of the most sincere devotion. She afterwards said, through an interpreter, that this was her prayer to her Great Spirit to enable her to understand and appreciate that these were her relatives and kindred she was among. The family and neighbors retaliated by demanding that Cynthia Ann and Prairie Flower give up wearing Indian clothing and insisting that Prairie Flower be given instruction in Scripture. Cynthia Ann was uncooperative. Things did not go well.
This is the end of the CD. The audiobook continues on the next CD.